All right, we're diving into some fascinating territory today. We're going to talk about the distal radius fracture chapter. And this is from, you know, the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook, orthopedia.com.
Edited by Bernstein, Penny, and Vayet.
Of course, always edited by the grades. But hey, before you even think about taking a test, or even more importantly, taking care of a patient, don't just rely on what we're saying here.
Yeah, do yourself a favor and read the book.
Absolutely. So today we're going deep, really deep into these distal radius fractures. You know, that lower part of your forearm bone right there at the wrist. Super common injury.
Oh, yeah. You see it all the time. And it might seem pretty simple on the surface, but trust me, there's a lot more to it. We're going to explore why that particular area is so prone to breaking and what exactly happens when it does.
I'm ready to get into it. I mean, think about it, right? You trip, you fall, and bam, fractured wrist. Why is that the go-to injury for a simple fall? And what are the doctors really looking at when they're studying those x-rays? Let's uncover all the essentials of these distal radius fractures so we can really understand the nuances of this injury.
We'll break it all down step by step. And of course, everything we're talking about today comes straight from that distal radius fracture chapter in Orthopedia. So, you know, we're working with a solid expert-backed foundation.
Gotta love a good reliable source. Okay, let's start with the basics. What exactly are we talking about when we say distal radius? Can you break it down for us?
Sure. So you've got two long bones in your forearm, the radius and the ulna. The distal radius is just the end portion of the radius, the one closer to your wrist. It's actually a key player in forming your wrist joint, connecting with those small carpal bones in your hand to make all those bending motions possible.
So that's how we get that, you know, up and down movement when we flex and extend our wrist. But it's not just about bending, is it? What about all that twisting and turning we do with our hands?
Exactly right. The distal radius also works together with the distal ulna, the other forearm bone, to allow for what we call pronation and supination. It's that rotation of your forearm that lets you turn your palm up or down. Think about using a screwdriver. That's pronation and supination in action. So it's all about how your wrist and forearm work in sync.
Fascinating how all those movements come together. So now we've got the what and the how of the distal radius. But why is it so darn fragile? What makes it such a prime target for breaks?
Good question. There are a couple of reasons for that. Firstly, if you look at the structure of the distal radius, there's this area called the distal metaphysis. It's that slightly wider section near the end of the bone.
Okay, I think I can picture that.
Now, at that point, the outer layer, the hard, dense part of the bone, known as the cortex, it actually gets a little thinner. And at the same time, you have more of this spongy inner bone called cancellous bone. So basically, you have a thinner outer shell and more of this honeycomb-like structure inside, which makes that area just a little weaker than solid bone.
So it's kind of like a structural compromise. Makes sense.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Now, add to that our natural instinct to brace ourselves with our hands when we fall. All that force from the impact gets transmitted straight to the wrist, especially to that vulnerable distal radius. It's no wonder it breaks so easily.
So it's like a perfect storm of anatomy and instinct leading to those, infamous dinner fork deformities we've heard about. Can you describe what that actually looks like?
Oh, yeah. The dinner fork deformity is quite distinctive. Picture this, right? You fall, land on your outstretched hand, and the force causes that distal radius to break. So now, looking at your forearm from the side, there's this noticeable dip or depression right where the fracture happened. And because of how you landed and the way the bone breaks, the broken end tends to point upwards toward the back of your hand. Plus, it shifts a little backward compared to the rest of your forearm.
So you get that bend in the wrist, kind of resembling a fork.
Precisely. The dip, the backward tilt, and the shift together, they really do create that dinner fork-like shape, the classic sign of this type of fracture.
So a fall can definitely do a number on that distal radius, but it's rarely the only thing that gets injured, right? What other things should we be looking out for when someone comes in with a suspected distal radius fracture?
Oh, absolutely. The distal radius might take the main hit, but that force ripples outward, fractures of the ulnar styloid. That's the little bony bump at the end of the ulna near your wrist. Those are really common. And even if it's not a full-blown fracture, you can have damage to the cartilage or the ligaments in that area. So good rule of thumb, distal radius fracture. Think about what else might be hurt around there too.
Remember to check for associated injuries.
Exactly.
Now, moving beyond just the bones, what about the other soft tissues in the wrist? Are they at risk as well?
Absolutely. Ligament injuries are definitely something to consider. Those ligaments are what stabilize your wrist joint, and they can get stretched or torn in the process. And here's one that's less common but super important to catch. Acute carpal tunnel syndrome. Sometimes a distal radius fracture can actually compress that nerve running through the carpal tunnel in your wrist.
Nerve compression? That sounds serious. What are the warning signs for that?
The biggest red flag is weakness, or even a complete inability to bend your thumb and index finger. You might also have tingling, numbness, or weird sensations in the parts of your hand that nerve supplies, which is basically parts of your thumb, index, middle, and even your ring finger. It's not the most frequent complication, but you got to be vigilant. Those symptoms, take them seriously.
Right, because nerve problems can lead to long-term issues if they're not addressed right away. And speaking of looking beyond the obvious, should we be thinking about potential injuries further up or down the arm too?
Absolutely. It's a golden rule in musculoskeletal injuries. Always check the joints above and below the injury. So in this case, you'd be looking at both the elbow and the smaller bones within the wrist itself. Get those x-rays. Do a thorough exam because you never know what you might find lurking beneath the surface.
Makes total sense. Don't get tunnel vision on the most obvious injury and miss something else that needs attention. The chapter also mentions a major associated condition linked to distal radius fractures. What is that?
That would be decreased bone mineral density. This can often lead to a condition that makes your bones thin and weak, you know, the one we often hear about, especially as we get older. And it's particularly important to consider, you know, older folks who experience these fractures from relatively minor falls.
Okay, so we've covered the anatomy, the reasons for its vulnerability, and potential accompanying injuries. Now let's talk about the patient experience. What are some common things someone with a distal radius fracture might experience and tell their doctor?
Well, most of the time it's a classic story of a fall onto an outstretched hand or a direct blow to the wrist. People usually complain about, you know, pain, obviously, and swelling around the injured area. Those are the bread and butter symptoms.
And when they're explaining how it happened, what details should they really focus on for the doctor?
The how is super important. The mechanism of injury, how much force was involved, all of that paints a clear picture. Like, did you fall from a ladder? Were you in a car accident? That's high energy and might mean more severe injuries or damage in other areas. But a simple trip and fall from standing, especially in someone older, that might raise a red flag for underlying bone weakness.
So the story behind the injury gives it context, and that can really guide the treatment. And after listening and examining, what's usually the next step?
X-rays, for sure. You need to see what's going on inside. Typically, you'd want at least three views. One from the back to front, that's the posterior anterior, or PA view, a side view called the lateral view, and an angled view, or oblique view. And it's crucial to get those carpal bones in the picture, too. We need to see if they're involved.
So you're looking at the whole wrist, not just the radius. Yeah. And what exactly are you looking for on those x-rays? What are the key things that jump out?
Well, first, you look for any disruption in the normal alignment of the bones. Are they where they should be, or are they out of place? Then you check those smooth joint surfaces. Those are covered in cartilage, and you want to make sure they're intact. Is there any damage there? You also need to see if the fracture goes into the joint involving the ulna or the carpal bones. And finally, how many pieces is the bone broken into? Is it a simple break or is it shattered? All these things matter.
So there's a lot more to it than just spotting a crack on the x-ray. There's a whole analysis going on. The chapter also talks about these specific measurements that are taken from the x-rays. Why are those so important?
Those measurements are all about defining exactly what the fracture looks like. The length, the sideways tilt, the forward or backward tilt of that distal radius. It's a standardized way to describe the injury, how much the bones are out of place, and how deformed the wrist is. And this helps doctors communicate, track healing, and make the best treatment decisions. It takes the guesswork out of it.
Okay, let's break down those measurements one by one. First, the one that looks at length. How is that measured, and what's considered normal?
So this measurement focuses on the length of the radius compared to the ulna at the wrist. On the x-ray, you draw two lines perpendicular to the long axis of the radius. One touches the tip of that bony bump on the thumb side of your wrist, you know, the radial styloid process. The other line touches the end of the ulna. The distance between those lines is what we're measuring. Normally, it's about 12 millimeters. But with a distal radius fracture, this distance is often less, which means the radius has shortened.
Got it. So it's all about the vertical relationship between those two bones. What about the sideways tilt? How do you figure that out?
That one's measured as an angle. Again, you have a line perpendicular to the long axis of the radius. Then you draw another line, this time from the tip of that bony bump on the thumb side to the end of the ulna. the angle between those two lines. That's what we're after. Typically, it should be somewhere between 20 and 25 degrees. But many distal radius fractures cause this angle to decrease, meaning the sideways tilt is off. Think about it. Normally, your wrist slopes upwards towards your thumb, but a fracture can disrupt that.
So that's the angle when you're looking at the wrist from the front or back. Now, what about the tilt going forward or backward? How do you measure that?
For that, we look at the lateral x-ray, the side view. We're looking for the angle between a line perpendicular to the radius and another line connecting the front and back edges of the end of the radius. Usually, the end of the radius tilts slightly forward towards the palm of your hand. But with fractures, you often see that forward tilt decrease, or even reverse, tilting backward instead. So instead of that natural forward tilt, the fracture can cause it to flatten out or even tilt in the opposite direction.
Interesting. So these three measurements really give a complete picture of how the fracture has affected the shape and alignment of the distal radius. It's all about precision. Now, let's go back to those fractures we discussed earlier that happen in older adults from seemingly minor falls. What makes those different?
These fractures in older adults, especially those over 65, are often what we call fragility fractures. They happen from low force events, like a simple fall from standing height or even just tripping. And the reason they're so common in this age group is that the bones are often weaker due to, you know, that condition we talked about earlier, which can make them more susceptible to breaking.
Right. Decreased bone mineral density, which can often lead to thinning and weakening of the bones. It's a significant factor as we age. And the chapter mentioned that these fractures aren't limited to just one age group, right?
Exactly. Distal radius fractures have this interesting pattern. They're most common in two distinct age groups. As we've discussed, one peak is in older adults, largely due to that bone fragility issue. But the other peak is in younger people, typically between 18 and 25 years old. However, these younger folks usually get these fractures from high-energy injuries, things like car accidents, sports injuries, or falls from heights. It's not about fragility in these cases. It's about the force of the impact.
So it's really important to consider the context, the mechanism of the injury. It's not just about the location of the fracture, but also the circumstances surrounding it. Now, shifting gears a bit, what are some red flags that should make a doctor think twice about a distal radius fracture? What might signal a deeper underlying issue or complication?
There are definitely a few things that should raise a red flag. First, as we mentioned before, if an older person gets this type of fracture from a minor fall, we have to think about the possibility of undiagnosed bone thinning or other metabolic bone diseases. Treating just the fracture without addressing the underlying bone weakness is a mistake. It's a missed opportunity to prevent potentially more serious fractures down the line, like hip or spine fractures. Those can be life-altering.
So don't just focus on the broken wrist. Look at the bigger picture.
Right, exactly. Another red flag is pain that goes beyond the wrist. If someone is also complaining about pain higher up in their arm, closer to their elbow, even if they don't specifically say their elbow hurts, we need to investigate. Get those elbow x-rays, there could be another injury there. And lastly, always be on the lookout for signs of acute carpal tunnel syndrome. This can happen after a distal radius fracture, and the telltale sign is weakness when trying to bend the thumb. There might be other sensory changes too, but that thumb weakness is a major warning sign.
So, vigilance is key. Always looking beyond the obvious to catch those potential complications. Now, let's talk treatment. What are some non-surgical options for managing these fractures?
Well, the good news is that many distal radius fractures, especially the ones where the bones haven't moved too much out of place, can heal well without surgery. The initial go-to is usually a splint called a sugar tongs splint. It wraps around the forearm and wrist, providing support on the front and back, but with softer sides that allow for swelling. It's all about comfort and stability in those early days.
And how long does someone typically wear that splint?
Usually about 5 to 7 days. Once the initial swelling starts to subside, they can transition to a short arm cast. That cast typically stays on for 6 to 8 weeks to allow the bone to heal properly. Sometimes, though, that cast might need to be changed midway through treatment, especially if the forearm muscles shrink a bit, making the cast too loose. You need that snug fit for proper healing.
Makes sense. What about those fractures that are displaced, meaning the bone fragments are out of alignment? Can those still be treated without surgery?
In many cases, yes, especially if it's a displaced fracture that doesn't involve the joint surface. We can do a procedure called a closed reduction, which basically means manually realigning the bones. The doctor carefully manipulates the fractured pieces back into a better position. And if we can achieve good alignment, and importantly, if it's stable, then we can often treat those fractures the same way as we treat the non-displaced ones with a cast for immobilization. It's all about restoring that proper alignment and letting the bone do its healing magic.
So non-operative management is a viable option for a good chunk of these fractures. But when do you absolutely need to go the surgical route?
There are five main scenarios where surgery is usually the best course of action. First, if the broken pieces are significantly out of place. Second, if we can't get those bones back where they belong, even with manipulation. Third, if the fracture is just plain unstable and keeps shifting out of place, even if we realign it initially. Fourth, if the bone is broken into multiple pieces, comminuted, as we say, because that's often a sign of instability. And fifth, if the fracture extends into the joint surface, requiring an open surgery to put those joint pieces back together perfectly.
I imagine those situations are more complex and require that extra level of intervention. What are some common surgical procedures used to fix these fractures?
There are several options, each with its pros and cons. Sometimes we use percutaneous pinning, where we insert wires or pins through the skin to hold the bone fragments together. Another option is external fixation. This involves attaching a frame to the bone above and below the fracture using pins that go through the skin. The frame holds everything in place while the bone heals, and then there's plating, where a metal plate is attached to the bone with screws, providing really solid fixation.
So quite a range of techniques, depending on the specifics of the fracture. It sounds like there's no one-size-fits-all approach.
Exactly right. Choosing the best surgical method depends on a lot of things. The type of fracture, the patient's age and health, the surgeon's experience and preference, even the resources available at the hospital. What works best in one case might not be the best option in another. It's about individualized care.
Now let's shift gears to prevention. Is there anything people can do to lower their risk of getting a distal radius fracture in the first place?
When we talk about prevention in this context, it's really about being proactive and addressing underlying bone weakness if it's present. This is especially crucial for older adults because, you know, strong bones are less likely to break. So preventing and managing bone thinning and those risk factors that contribute to it, that's what we should be focusing on.
Right. So it's about more than just protecting your wrist. It's about overall bone health, especially as we get older. And that brings us to our five key terms recap. These are some must-knows for understanding distal radius fractures. Ready to go through them?
Absolutely. Let's start with that bony bump at the end of the ulna, the ulnar siloid. It's a common site for fractures alongside the distal radius. While a fracture of this small bump itself doesn't usually need specific treatment, it's a reminder to always consider the possibility of other injuries lurking around. Remember, assess the whole area, not just the most obvious fracture.
Remember to check for associated injuries.
Exactly. Next up, we have fragility fracture. It's a term we use for a fracture that occurs in weakened bone, typically from a low-energy injury, so an older person falling from standing height and breaking their wrist. That's a classic fragility fracture, and it's a huge red flag for underlying bone pinning. Recognizing and addressing this can help prevent more serious fractures later on.
Don't miss the opportunity.
Absolutely. Now, onto something more visual, the dinner fork deformity. This is the classic appearance of a distal radius fracture after a fall. It gets its name from that distinct shape, the depression at the fracture site, the upward angle of the broken bone, and the backward shift. It's like a visual clue that tells the doctor exactly what kind of fracture they're dealing with.
Okay, on to treatment. What about that initial splint we talked about?
That's the sugar tongue splint. It's the go-to for those early stages after a distal radius fracture. It's designed to provide support while also accommodating swelling. Remember, swelling is a natural part of the healing process, and we need to factor that in when choosing immobilization methods.
Makes sense. And finally, let's talk about that all-important X-ray measurement.
Right. We're talking about palmar tilt. This measurement tells us how much the end of the radius tilts forward or backward on a side view X-ray. Documenting this, along with the measurements of length and sideways tilt, gives us a precise picture of the fracture displacement. It's all about accurate assessment and documentation.
So those five terms really capture the essence of distal radius fractures.
Yeah.
From associated injuries and bone health to appearance, initial management, and accurate measurement. It's amazing how much goes into understanding what might seem like a simple wrist fracture.
Couldn't agree more. It's a great example of how looking at the whole picture, considering all those factors, leads to better patient care.
We have just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayet. It's available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, Before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. You'll be glad you did.
And as we wrap up our deep dive into distal radius fractures, it's clear that what might initially seem like a straightforward wrist break is actually much more complex than meets the eye. Understanding the anatomy, the mechanisms involved, and the potential associated conditions is crucial for comprehensive care.
Absolutely. It really makes you think about all those other seemingly minor injuries out there that might actually be red flags for something more serious. What other seemingly minor injuries could be signaling bigger problems that we should be paying more attention to?
That's a great question to ponder.
Food for thought. And that's a wrap for today's deep dive. Thanks for joining us.
Until next time.